However, on the other hand, as Dave mentioned, the name Chenault is a bit of a flag because later on, Chenault, who was a rabid supporter of Chiang Kai-shek, he and then especially his wife after he died became very, very early proponents of the China lobby and were among the people that helped to start the entire McCarthy era off on its way by their allegations about waffling in the State Department and lukewarm support for anti-communist governments like Chiang Kai-shek's and their and accusations of this sort. Anyway, back to John Birch again and his military and his intelligence background. Going to read a short segment here from a book called The Secret File on John Birch, written by James and Marty Heffley, H-E-F-L-E-Y, copyright 1980 by Tyndall House Publishers, Inc. Okay. Although official U.S. policy viewed the communist movement as an internal problem, the Heffleys write, the Chinese would have to solve for themselves. The American military had been on the scene long enough to realize the potential danger to peace in China. Wiedemeyer and the OSS men were determined the communists would not take advantage of the end-of-war confusion. When John, that's John Birch, and Miller kept their morning radio schedule on August 19th, they learned that both were bound for the same city, Suzhou, where a large Japanese headquarters facility and airfield was located. In the euphoria of knowing that the war was over, they disregarded code and talked openly about how they would get there. Quote, I'm taking a junk down the Yellow, meaning the Yellow River, to Pengpu, and I'll catch the train north to Suzhou from there, Miller said. Why not come with me? Skipping on down. The next morning, John, again John Birch, assembled his party. They included three other Americans, Lieutenant Laird Ogle, a specialist in morale intelligence, Sergeant Albert C. Myers, a radio technician, and Albert Grimes, a civilian OSS operative skilled in counter-espionage. Grimes wore a 14th Air Force captain's uniform and was second in command. Assisting the uniformed Americans were five Chinese officers and two Japanese-speaking Koreans, who went along as interpreters. The group of 11 carried 27 pieces of baggage and three radios. One of the Chinese, Lieutenant Dung Fu Quan, was assigned as John Birch's aide. They left about 1 p.m., trekked northward to a town on the Yellow River, and took a junk, a day's journey northeast, to another point on the river. They again turned north, walking all night until they reached Kwe Te on the Lunghai Railroad about noon. Here they were received courteously by a Japanese commander, who assured them that they would be well received in Suzhou. However, he warned that the communist guerrillas were causing trouble along the railroad to the east. The group spent Wednesday and Thursday nights at Kwe Te, then proceeded with two Chinese who had been collaborating with the Japanese, General Peng and his orderly Lei Yuqing. General Peng was to escort them to his counterpart, the puppet General Ho, in Suzhou, in other words, another man who had been working for the Japanese. It was understood that John was still in command of the mission. They boarded an eastbound train at Kwe Te the next morning. John still believed the communists would not interdict an American mission on a main railroad line traveling under direct orders of General Wiedemeyer. They encountered no delay for the first 45 miles, then the train halted at Tangshan Station. After a few minutes of waiting, John sent the Koreans to ask the Japanese station master what was the holdup. The Koreans reported back that the line had been sabotaged ahead, and communists, Japanese, and Chinese puppet troops were also fighting in the area. Until the line was repaired and things calmed, the train would remain at Tangshan. Okay, skipping on down. They talk about a priest who came and a Portuguese Catholic priest came and told them that the communists had killed many of his men. John Birch and Ogle hurried back to the railroad and found a Japanese patrol had arrived on a handcar bringing replacement rails. Some of the Jap soldiers were pounding the new rails in place. Others had taken up defensive positions on both sides of the railroad as if they expected trouble. At John's request, the patrol commander directed his men to move the handcar over the break and load in the group's baggage. He and his men then escorted them to the station, where a large supply train was guarded by a garrison of about 600 Japanese troops.
Now, the rest of the story here basically is sort of consists of dialogue, reconstructed dialogue, as the Heffleys have sort of used it. As they state in the beginning of the book, the dialogue here is invented by them. The events are real, but they sort of used a little literary license, I guess you could say, to fill in the dialogue here. So the rest of this account of the death of John Birch is dialogue. We're not going to go read you the dialogue per se. We'll tell you basically what happened. John Birch, now recall his mission here. He's traveling along railway lines with active assistance from disarmed, I guess you could really regard them as turned, Japanese soldiers, because recall that we were, meaning U.S. policy in that area through Chiang Kai-shek, was willing to enlist the arms support of the Japanese against the Chinese communists, in essence affecting a uniform switch, as we mentioned. Perhaps more importantly, John Birch, now recall that Wiedemeyer had authorized American forces and, in particular, OSS, to accept the surrender of Japanese on behalf of Chiang Kai-shek, and this put them in direct conflict with the Chinese communists. And recall, of course, that throughout this time there's been a continuation of combat. In other words, this was 1 week to the day after VJ Day that John Birch died, and basically the fighting has gone on unabated. The fighting that had proceeded throughout World War II is still going on, only a nominal shift of uniforms on behalf of the Japanese, who are guarding railway lines here. And John Birch now is working with, among others, two Chinese puppet soldiers who have been collaborating with the Japanese, and specifically part of his mission was to escort them to the puppet General Ho in Suzhou, their ultimate destination. As seen here, these groups were receiving active aid from the Japanese, the very Japanese who had bombed Pearl Harbor and who had been America's enemies 1 week before, and who, as we mentioned, were involved in a continuous combat throughout this period, stretching, of course, throughout World War II and right up to this point. We're in August 15th, 1945. And that basically these are the people with whom John Birch was working and traveling. Now, what Birch went into Chinese territory was stopped by the Chinese, who took due note of his puppet associates and his association with the Japanese. However, they were quite willing to allow him to pass through their territory and to fulfill his request to meet with their commanding officer. The bone of contention was that they wanted to disarm Birch and his party. Birch and his party refused to be disarmed, and in fact, according to all accounts, some of Birch's own associates warned him that his attitude was a little too truculent. At any rate, eventually, the attempt to disarm them by the Chinese led to a fight, and there was shooting, and John Birch and several of the Chinese were killed. Okay, so but these are the circumstances under which Birch died. Basically, for all intents and purposes, fighting with the Axis here. He's working with Chinese puppet troops and Japanese troops, and note that the Japanese are fully armed here and are taking up defensive positions on this railroad. Then when the Chinese communists want to disarm him, Birch stages an argument and is killed. So that is how John Birch died. Now, returning again to the John Birch Society in California politics, an assessment of John Birch's death here from one of his OSS compatriots, again the author Brian W. Stevens. On Friday, March 31st, 1961, Joseph S. Sample, S-A-M-P-L-E, president of a radio and television company in Billings, Montana, and who served in the same Office of Strategic Services with John Birch, wrote in his byline column in the weekly Yellowstone News that John Birch was no hero and did not die in glory. Sample wrote, Birch was a man with no particularly distinguishing characteristics, a little stiff perhaps, but a not very high regard for the Chinese and somewhat self-important, but nothing unusual. If he had strong political convictions, they were not in evidence. Describing the situation in China in 1945, when civil war seemed inevitable, Sample said Birch was assigned a mission in central China. So basically, in the minds of at least one of his compatriots, he was no hero, and the circumstances we've already recited. He was basically acting on behalf of the Chiang Kai-shek government to accept the surrender of Japanese troops, working with Chinese puppet troops, and with Japanese who had been kept under arms and were continuing to fight, even though this was barely a week after the official Japanese surrender. And remember that the all covert operations were going through Wiedemeyer's office, and that Chiang's chief of military intelligence was Louis Siefkin.
Okay, and with that, and since we're coming up to the top of the hour, we're going to take another short break.
We are indeed going to take a short break, and I bet you're all quite glad of that. Anyway, that has been a long segment from Radio Free America number 11. Some music right now, and then we're going to come back live right here on KFJC Los Altos Hill.
And welcome back. This is Nip Tuck in the studios with Dave Emery. Continuing with Radio Free America after a very long tape segment from Radio Free America 11. And we're getting self-referential here, folks. And a long musical break. Robert Seidler, Christian Boy, and followed by Al Stewart, The Road to Moscow. And we hope you've gotten a chance now to get up and shake out the kinks. Those of you who are actually marathoning through to the very end and are going to listen to the whole thing, because we got plenty more stuff to get into, and we're going to do that right now.
Okay, now, we're looking, and we're going to be winding up here in a hurry, at the Asian wing of WACL. Recall, we're looking at four main groupings, North and South America, Europe and Eurasia, and Asia. We've taken a look at the Kuomintang, some of the development of that, how it intersects not only with our own national security establishment, but the very cozy relationship with which the Kuomintang was able to achieve with the Japanese national security establishment, with which it was, to a certain extent, at war, but obviously able to make some accommodations nonetheless, and some very neat accommodations afterward. And again, we're taking a look at the Asian branch of WACL, not necessarily to look at the history of the development of the Republic of South Korea or of the Taiwanese Republic, but specifically we're taking a look at how these, how specifically the Korean National Security Establishment, of which COSA and the Unification Church are perhaps the single most important element, and the Kuomintang fit into the international fascist community. Okay? Now, in the Village Voice article that Nip Tuck read at the very beginning of this program, there was a long and repeated reference to the Unification Church, to the COSA organization, very much involved with the Nicaraguan Freikorps, if you will, with the Contras, and specifically the Unification Church, which we went over in considerable detail in Radio Free America number 7, is not only a key extension of the South Korean intelligence system and national security establishment, but is also in a very, very important wing of the World Anti-Communist League. Now, in Radio Free America number 7, which is available from DAVCOR, there is a discussion of how the Unification Church grew out of the Imperial Japanese National Security Establishment. Recall that Korea was a Japanese colony from the time when the Japanese took it from Russia during the Russo-Japanese War in 1905 until Japan was defeated in World War II. So for 40 years, almost half a century, Korea is a Japanese colony. The people who moved up into the Republic of South Korea's National Security Establishment all got their start with the Imperial Japanese Fascist National Security Establishment. Documentation on that in Radio Free America number 7. Those of you who'd like to pursue that in greater length are invited to look at a book called Gifts of Deceit by Robert Becher, upon which much of our program on that date was based. Now, what we're going to be looking at this evening is we're going to repeat a short section from Radio Free America number 7, and specifically we're going to be taking a look at the intersection of the Unification Church with a key person who was involved with the Japanese Patriotic Societies. Now, reviewing very quickly another element that we looked at in Radio Free America number 7, and by the way, a process we're going to look at in great detail when we get to a Radio Free America show on the rise of fascism. But in a nutshell, the Patriotic Societies in Japan functioned as an extension of the Japanese Intelligence Service and National Security Establishment. What they were mystical societies which espoused a combination of nationalist and religious doctrine. It was sort of a mystical doctrine, not unlike in some ways the Unification Church, in that it was partially religious, partially nationalistic, and the religious aspects and the nationalistic aspects were fused. In turn, the Patriotic Societies served as an extension of the Japanese intelligence services, using street thugs and assassins to dispose of key influential political figures that the Japanese National Security Establishment wanted removed so they could begin their war of aggression. The Patriotic Societies were not only instrumental in bringing fascism to Japan by systematically assassinating the democratic opponents of Japanese fascism, much as happened in Germany. Again, in Germany, Hitler's rise to power was paved by a wave of assassinations performed by the Freikorps, an underground extension of the military. In Japan, much the same thing happened. The Patriotic Societies, these religious-nationalistic organizations, systematically, at the behest and functioning with the intelligence services and military of Japan, assassinated all of the democratic leaders, or all of the key democratic leaders, in Japan, paving the way for Japanese fascism. In turn, the Patriotic Society served as the main vehicle for the propagation of Japanese nationalism, and in turn, and all of these are very important points, in turn, the Patriotic Society served as very important foreign intelligence apparatuses. So, basically, the Patriotic Societies function in three ways. All of them as extensions of the Imperial Japanese security services and military. They assassinate the democratic leadership of Japan, bringing fascism to Japan in the process. They serve as the primary vehicles for nationalism and militarism in Japan. They also serve as a very important function of overseas military intelligence for Japan. Now, we looked at these in Radio Free America number 7 rather briefly. Summing that up, the information which I talked about, I'm just going to read you a short section from the jacket of a book that, again, we will go into at great length when we go into the rise of fascism. The book was authored by a man named Hugh Bias, B-Y-A-S. He was the former Tokyo correspondent for the New York Times. It's called Government by Assassination, published in hardcover by Alfred A. Knopf in 1942, right after Pearl Harbor. And of the Japanese Patriotic Societies, Hugh Bias writes, and this is from the jacket notes, and actually endorsement of the book itself. Only a man who lived in Japan for 23 years could produce this sensational revelation of the secret power of the Japanese militarists. In Japan, the army possesses a kind of autonomy which immunizes it from control by any other agency. Long ago, Mr. Bias saw that the intoxication of this immunity would lead to war, and so he spent many years ferreting out from the secretive Japanese how the militarists gained their fantastic power. His book, therefore, is to Japan what Rauschning's Revolution of Nihilism was to Germany. Starting from the grassroots of Japanese politics, it moves steadily toward the amazing disclosure of principles. At bottom, the Japanese army is closely allied with gangsterism. The so-called patriotic societies which do its dirty work are nothing more than leagues of murderers, blackmailers, and thieves. Bias shows how these terrorists made contact years ago with certain groups of appreciative younger officers, and how consequently almost every civilian leader who curbed the army's power was assassinated. And what we're going to take a look at now is a man named Yoshio Kodama reviewing his involvement not only with the Japanese patriotic societies, which I've just described, and with the Japanese Kempei Tai, its security service, but after that, and perhaps more importantly for our purposes here, with residual Japanese fascist elements and with the Unification Church, a key element of WACL.
And again, just to put these things back into perspective, remember the first article we read from the Village Voice, remember Ronald Reagan's message to the World Anti-Communist League, of whom all of these different people we've been discussing are component members, Yoshio Kodama among them, message about them doing the work of democracy and God bless you all. Again, the book Jack and Hugh Bias's book, basically characterizing the people involved in the Japanese patriotic societies, Yoshio Kodama at least, and Reiichi Sasakawa, both of whom very important members of the World Anti-Communist League that Reagan so blithely credits with its good work for democracy and the godly way of life, characterized on Bias's book as blackmailers, thieves, street gangs, etc., etc. And we're going to see a little bit more about Yoshio Kodama and fill in just exactly some of the details, anyway, as to how this man became a good buddy of the Reagan administration. Again, we're going to read a little bit from a book, Spooks, excellent book, Spooks, The Haunting of America, The Private Use of Secret Agents by Jim Hogan, H-O-U-G-A-N, a book we've used quite often on our public affairs efforts here at KFJC. The book is published by William Morrow & Company, and copyright 1978. Nowhere so much as in Japan is the criminality of those involved so clearly revealed. There, Lockheed's agent of influence, that's of course the same Lockheed Aerospace, it's just down the road from us here in Silicon Valley. There, Lockheed's agent of influence was a strange and dangerous man named Yoshio Kodama, spelled K-O-D-A-M-A, a Japanese extremist with powerful links to the Park dictatorship in Korea, not to mention his own private army. Kodama has lived a life of intrigue and high melodrama that may be unmatched in the annals of non-fiction. An ultranationalist and terrorist leader at 15, Kodama immersed himself in the political bedlam of Depression Japan, joining an even score of conspiratorial societies with such names as the Blood Brotherhood, Holy War Execution League, Federation of Radical Patriotic Workers, and the Capital Rise Asia Academy. These societies, many of them murderous and fly-by-night affairs, provided him with a precarious living. Ostensibly political, they were often no more than street gangs manipulated for private ends by wealthy industrialists, the police, and the army. Let me just point out something very quickly before we go on with this. This is exactly what the whole point of our Aryan Nations broadcast was. We were talking about people that were characterized in the newspapers as merely being gangs of dangerous thugs, just as the various Nazi groups were in Germany, just as these groups, according to Hogan, were characterized in Japan. But in fact, as we pointed out, the Aryan Nations are in the same situation, were being manipulated by wealthy industrialists, the police, and the army. Again, a very similar situation. It had terrible results in Germany and Japan, and we're still on the radio here, and we're still hoping for the best. Going on with Hogan's book. They fought the communists and one another with equal frequency and underwent a continual factionalization. Often the societies consisted of no more than a dozen friends, a post office box, and stolen gelignite. It was in this right-wing milieu, part underworld and part underground, that Kodama plotted to conduct a battue of the emperor's entourage, a state massacre that would eliminate at one stroke all the most powerful men in the realm. A premature explosion led the plot awry, however, and Kodama found himself beginning the first in a series of prison terms meted out to him for his terrorist activities. Molding himself into the image of a 20th century samurai, devoting himself to the martial arts and traditional Buddhist meditation practices,
The young Kadama refined his political beliefs as well. By 1940, he'd forged a peculiar ideology, combining elements of fascism with those of Japanese feudalism. He'd also forged powerful links to Japan's military intelligence apparatus, carrying out numerous secret missions to Manchuria. As a reward for his intelligence work, he was entrusted with the task of supplying the Japanese Navy in wartime. Establishing the Kodama Kikan, or Kodama Agency, he built a financial empire from a handful of rooms in Shanghai's Shin Asia Hotel. According to formerly secret reports of the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps, Kadama accomplished the Navy's ends at gunpoint, taking hostages and forcing Chinese villagers to sell him the goods he demanded. Paying a pittance to the Chinese, he then resold the goods at a fabulous profit to the Imperial Navy. Systematically looting China of its raw materials, he amassed a personal fortune of colossal dimensions. To accomplish that, he acquired heroin on the black market in Tokyo, traded it for tungsten in Shanghai, sold the tungsten for yen, used the yen to buy guns, sold the guns in Borneo for gold, exchanged the gold for industrial diamonds, and in the meantime, cornered the Shanghai radium market by emptying the hospitals of their supplies. In addition, he operated salt mines, iron mines, farms, fisheries, an orphanage, a molybdenum mine, and a secret munitions factory and secret munitions factories throughout central China. In his heroin deals, he sometimes burned the consumer, and there were unproven allegations that the yen spent in China was counterfeit. Not that it mattered, since it was useless to the Chinese in any case. He came to be regarded as the man behind the Kempeitai, or secret police, financing its Shanghai office in return for its, quote, physical support. Intelligence reports show that this was sometimes bloody work, revealing that Kadama was suspected of assassinating his partner and of taking part in a massacre of Chinese at the Shin Asia Hotel.
Okay, now, basically, one of the things to remember here, interrupting the account ever so briefly, is that one of the key ways that Kadama was able to finance the Kempeitai, the Japanese intelligence service, was by setting up not only some legitimate businesses, but also some smuggling operations. Now, when we get into his later association with the Unification Church in Wacol, remember the Unification Church. Initially, and in fact, still an extension of the Imperial Japanese, Korean National Security Establishment, and in turn, the Japanese National Security Establishment, Moon's intelligence activities and paramilitary activities are largely financed by his huge business network, an interesting parallel here.
Indeed. Okay, and just wanted to mention, you're listening to KFJC, Los Altos Hills. Repeating the last bit. Intelligence reports show that this was sometimes bloody work, revealing that Kadama was suspected of assassinating his partner and of taking part in a massacre of Chinese at the Shin Asia Hotel. At war's end, the 34-year-old was a brigadier general, a cabinet advisor, and the possessor of a financial hoard that included half a room full of platinum, sacks of industrial diamonds, and an undetermined amount of foreign currency, and upward of 3.5 billion yen, which at the time was about $175 million, not including illiquid assets. Just how much Kadama was worth, however, could not be exactly ascertained. All documents of the Kadama Kikan were burned at the end of the war, and Kadama himself admits that he hid most of his wealth. Imprisoned as a war crime suspect in 1946, he'd been attempting to organize a new political party for Japan, a party in naked emulation of those that governed the United States. This democratic pretense, however, failed to deceive American occupation authorities. An intelligence assessment of Kadama concludes, "In summary, Kadama appears to be a man doubly dangerous. His long and fanatic involvement in ultranationalistic activities, violence included, and his skill in appealing to youth make him a man who, if released from internment, would surely be a grave security risk. In addition, there is the outstanding probability to be reckoned with that, as a result of his hearty cooperation with the war effort, he has a large fortune to back up whatever activities he might see fit to undertake. His success in the difficulties of securing supplies in wartime for the Navy mark him as one who could very easily become a big-time operator in Japan's reconstruction period. Persistent rumors as to his black market profits in his Shanghai period, plus his known opportunism, are forceful arguments that he would be as unscrupulous in trade as he was in ultranationalism. Kadama's past performance indicates that he is the sort of man G2, which is military intelligence, considers more dangerous than either the superannuated ideologists or the professional men who aided Japan's wartime effort for reasons of patriotism or survival of their professional interests. Dangerous potentialities for the future." Another report prepared by Kadama's chief inquisitor, Lieutenant Frank O'Neill, concludes, quote, I am satisfied that Kadama or his associates, for whom he is responsible, committed numerous acts of violence in China in the acquisition by foul means or fair of commodities and goods belonging to the Chinese. Shortly after this assessment was made, and in spite of it, Kadama was released without trial. Walking out of prison with him was Nobusuke Kishi, a future prime minister, and 17 other war crime suspects who would become the financial and political spine of a new democratic Japan. Why was Kadama released? The last pages of his diary give a clue. Quote, who, in this age of ideological confusion, is capable of bringing the laboring masses, influenced completely by communist ideals, and rampaging like a wounded beast, under control? The bestial roar of the Communist Party reaches into my cell through the barred windows of Sugamo Prison. I can hear the dull thud of the marching feet of thousands of communists advancing towards the Bolshevization of Japan. Who will fight the last fight with them? Behind the steel bars of Sugamo, this young life of mine, burning with the passionate ardor of a love of my country and of justice, strains against the bars that hold it in. Unquote. A few days after Kadama's release, Lieutenant Frank O'Neill was reported to have predicted, quote, 10 years from today, this man Kadama is going to be a great leader of Japan. He was right. Working behind the scenes, Kadama established the Liberal Democratic Party, using funds hoarded from his Shanghai days. It soon became the most important political party in Asia, leading some to suspect that Kadama's release from Sugamo had been engineered by the fledgling CIA. Whether that is so or not, Kadama rapidly consolidated his hold over Japan's ultranationalists and reestablished contact with anti-communist gangsters and street punks from the Tokyo Ginza. Before long, his flunkies would brag in print of his role behind the scenes, describing him as, quote, the driving force in Japanese politics. Skipping down. Sometime after the mooting of Operation Project Ike, this is a visit by Eisenhower to Japan that was killed by the mobilization of large amounts of people in the streets of Japan. Sometime after the mooting of Operation Project Ike, Kadama seems to have joined the Unification Church, gravitating toward that organization through the auspices of Ryuichi Sasakawa, an old friend of Kadama's, a veteran of Sugamo, that's the prison, remember, and the Shanghai-Manchuria intrigues. Sasakawa came into enormous wealth after the war, becoming, among many other things, chairman of the Japan Shipbuilding Association. An ultranationalist whose views paralleled Kadama's, Sasakawa established himself in his friend's mold, becoming one of Japan's leading kurumaku.
This is the fellow described in the Village Voice who described himself in the Village Voice article as the world's richest fascist.
Just as Kadama privately financed military exercises on the remote island of Choju, Sasakawa lavished money on Tokyo's martial arts societies, a euphemism that might cover everything from karate clubs to paramilitary cabals.
In which also hard bring to mind the patriotic societies of an earlier era.
Sasakawa's pet project, however, was Win Over Communism, WOC, a fundraising subsidiary of the Unification Church. Sasakawa served as WOC's chairman and Kadama as its chief advisor. This needn't indicate any special religiosity on the part of either man. On the contrary, the Unification Church's evangelical anti-communism is a bulwark of South Korean, quote, stability, and as such, protective of Kadama's investments in that country. Still, the implications of Kadama's relationship to WOC and the allegedly Reverend Sun Myung-moon are interesting to ponder. The recipient of untold Lockheed millions, Kadama was the aircraft firm's agent in both Japan and Korea. Other corporations, notably Gulf, have been shaken down for, quote, political contributions by Korea's Park regime, the quid quo being the right to do business there. It's almost incredible that Kadama, with his influence and investments in South Korea, should not have provided Park's minions with support, financial and otherwise. If he did, then his affiliation with WOC is particularly suggestive. Specifically, it raises the specter of the Lockheed Corporation subsidizing the Moonies' spread from Seoul to Savannah by means of bribes laundered through Hong Kong by an apostate Spanish missionary for delivery in so-called beacons boxes to the industry's kurumaku in Tokyo.
Okay, now, we've been looking at the World Anti-Communist League as a reformation of the fascism we saw during with the Axis nations and with the anti-Comintern pact. We've taken a look at the Kuomintang and how they fit into the fascist community around the time of World War II and shortly thereafter. We've taken a look at one element of the most important element of the South Korean national security establishment, the Unification Church, and we've taken a look specifically at the involvement of a Japanese intelligencer and war criminal named Yoshio Kadama, who in turn was a key man with regard to the patriotic societies, and as we've said, he supported much of the Kempei Tai activity through commercial ventures and smuggling ventures, which is very reminiscent of what the Unification Church is doing now. And again, here is a hard connecting link between the Unification Church and the patriotic societies, and one of the things that we suggested in Radio Free America number 7, in which we're going to reintroduce, is to examine the Unification Church as perhaps a modern patriotic society. In other words, an extension of the South Korean intelligence service, which in turn, explicitly fascist in nature, which in turn is being used to take over this country and is obviously a very, very important vehicle for overseas military intelligence. Now, for the rest of the broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at the European and Eurasian branch of WACL, and specifically we're going to be taking a look at the anti-Bolshevik nations, the ABN. Now, in a nutshell, the Soviet Union is descended from the old Russian Empire. Basically, the Tsar conquered a bunch of different territories, and when the subjects of the Russian Empire revolted, what the world wound up with basically was a headless empire, a bunch of states which had been joined artificially through military conquest, and which then found themselves in a sort of a spontaneous political union. And obviously, many of the member peoples had nationalistic aspirations of their own. The Ukrainians, many Asian and Middle Eastern peoples in not only the Asian part of the Soviet Union, but also those parts of it that could be considered Eurasian or Middle Eastern. Many of the peoples in the Soviet Union are of Turkic extraction and are very similar to the kinds of ethnic peoples found in the Middle East. We're going to be taking a look at some of the Ukrainians and Ukrainian nationalism, some of the pan-Turkists and some of the Turkic-speaking peoples in the Soviet Union, and how these groups come together in the anti-Bolshevik nations, the ABN. The key name there is Lev Dobryansky, Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. Now, by way of introducing the anti-Bolshevik nations, which is going to occupy the rest of the broadcast this evening, we're going to read from a superb manuscript, unpublished, unfortunately, called The Dallas Conspiracy. The Dallas Conspiracy was authored by Peter Dale Scott, who's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. An unpublished manuscript which is available from Tom Davis Books. We'll give you that address at the end of the program. About the ABN, Peter Dale Scott writes as follows in The Dallas Conspiracy. The anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, or ABN, with its American lobby, the AFABN, the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Nations, was similar to, but slightly to the right of, the CIA-supported Assembly of Captive European Nations, or ACEN, with its U.S. CIA front, the American Friends of the Captive Nations, headed by Christopher Emmett. Whereas the ACEN lobbied for the liberation of Poland, Czechoslovakia, and the rest of the area between the Iron Curtain and the USSR, the ABN looked also for the liberation of the Ukraine, Armenia, Georgia, Kosakia, Azerbaijan, Idel-Ural, Turkestan, and of other ethnic nationalities inside the 1939 borders of the Soviet Union. And again, the Soviet Union is an amalgam of a wide variety of different peoples, many of whom had independent nationalistic aspirations. These sometimes merged with a doctrinaire anti-communism and became fascism. It's sort of a mixed bag, and however, after the war, this mixed bag became, and during the war and after the war, World War II, that is, this mixed bag became essentially fascist. Continuing with Scott's narrative, at the heart of the ABN alliance were the resources of two actual post-war underground movements, the Hungarian Freedom Fighters and the Ukrainian OUN or Underground Army. Interrupting briefly, recall that Hungary fought on the side of the Axis in World War II as well. Continuing. By 1960, however, the ABN had come to concentrate on psychological and political warfare. Thus, it competed with Russian emigre organizations such as the MTS, or Solidarists, to be discussed shortly, for places in U.S.-supported Psy-War activities like Radio Liberation, later renamed Radio Liberty, in Munich. Recall, that's a Galen operation, and interjecting very briefly here, the Ukrainian nationalists and the ABN in general are inseparable from the Galen organization. They are a major element of it and simply can't be separated at any point from the Galen organization. Referring to ABN and Radio Liberty, it also participated in planning for a grand world alliance of world anti-communist forces to be called the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, or WACCFL, whose composition is indicated by the 15-man steering committee elected at a preparatory conference in Mexico City in March of 1958. Recall we read some of that list in the beginning of the broadcast. The Mexico City conference was itself called in response to the Taipei statement of an international group meeting in October of 1957 in Taiwan. Chiang Kai-shek of Taiwan, Syngman Rhee of South Korea, and Diem of South Vietnam were each represented in this steering committee by a top figure in their respective party apparatus. German veterans of Hitler's frustrated anti-Comintern and Ostpolitik programs were included, notably Fritz Kramer, spelled C-R-A-M-E-R, of the CIAS, Committee for Information and Social Activity, a former officer of the Abwehr, that's German military intelligence, in Riga and Lisbon from 1939 to 45. Alfred Gielen, spelled G-I-E-L-E-N, CIAS Secretary General and former Nazi publicist for Goebbels' anti-Comintern, became the WACCFL Steering Committee's Regional Secretary for Europe. And interestingly enough, in a footnote to the passage I just read you, Peter Dale Scott adds about Fritz Kramer, spelled C-R-A-M-E-R, in the 1950s, Kramer was also president of Eberhard Taubert's Volksbund für Frieden und Freiheit, or VFF, an industry-financed private vigilante group to ferret out and maintain files on German leftists. Now, of course, that's very similar to the American Security Council, so it's interesting that a key member of the WACCFL, the steering committee which was to give birth, I guess, act as the midwife for Wackel in 1966, Fritz Kramer, C-R-A-M-E-R, former Nazi intelligence officer, ran just such an organization in combination with a man named Eberhard Taubert. Okay, so a similar kind of organization to the American Security Council. And interestingly enough, Taubert, the man he worked with here, is also interesting. Taubert, the head of, and again, returning to the footnote here, Taubert, the head of Division Pro 2 in Goebbels' propaganda ministry, had, quote, prided himself on being the wire puller behind the anti-Comintern propaganda organization. That from Kurt Tauber's Beyond Eagle and Swastika, Middletown, Connecticut, Wesleyan University Press, 67. So, interestingly enough, now, again, Fritz Kramer, a member of the WACCFL steering committee, key Wackel member here, not only a former Nazi intelligencer, but a co-head of a private intelligence group, which basically provided industry with files on political activists. Also worth noting that the person Eberhard Taubert, who was co-head of this VFF group with Fritz Kramer, was a former participant in Goebbels' propaganda ministry in the anti-Comintern effort. Significant because the American Security Council, similar to function to VFF, also, of course, through the Jung Organization, had links with Goebbels' anti-Comintern effort. Again, looking at Wackel as the second anti-Comintern. Continuing here with Peter Dale Scott's account. The American representatives were veteran China lobbyist Charles Edison of the John Birch Society and American Security Council and Lev Dobryansky, a Ukrainian-American Army Reserve officer and professor at Georgetown University with close links to Army intelligence circles. The ABN had two of the 15 seats on the World Committee, one less than Latin America. Its representatives were Yaroslav Stetsko, S-T-E-T-Z-K-O, briefly a premier of the short-lived Ukrainian Republic at the time of the 1941 German invasion, and Ferenc Farkas, F-A-R-K-A-S, the ABN military chief, who commanded the army of Arrow Cross chief Ferenc Szalasi, executed as a war criminal, against the Russians in World War II. So, again, the explicitly fascist and pro-Third Reich orientation of many of the component members of ABN has been touched on here, and we're going to develop here as we go.
Okay. And we've got coming up here some other stuff. We're going to be getting into some other remnants and some other parts of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. But again, we have to stress that the makeup of the group and the fact that basically nothing has changed, they've only become more respectable because their leaders are now connected to our current administration. And we've been focusing on some of the Bolshevist groups, the anti-Bolshevist groups from Eastern Europe specifically, and we're going to be probably talking about them more before the broadcast ends. We're coming up on some things having to do with the Middle East, but before we get to that, we have to talk about some of the situations that perhaps even going back a little further than we've been going in the show, talk about some of the situations that led to this particular formation, actually even back before the 30s and before the Nazis came to power, and clear back to the early days of the struggle between Russia, the early Soviet Socialist Republic, and Poland.
Okay, now, one of the things to remember about Poland, in fact, about all political movements, is that they're not homogeneous. Poland was basically a fascist country, even though it was conquered by Nazi Germany and perhaps suffered worse than any other nation, with perhaps the exception of USSR, under Nazi rule. The Poles were just devastated by the 6 years of Nazi rule, or 5 years of Nazi rule. However, it's important to remember that that Poland, under Marshal Pilsudski, was, for all intents and purposes, a fascist country. It was explicitly anti-labor and anti-Semitic and anti-Soviet, very imperialistic in its aspirations. And, however, Pilsudski simply, like the Poles were extremely nationalistic, still are, but in that period, whereas Poland had been a major power in previous centuries, there was a, or I should say because Poland had been a major power in previous centuries, there was a sort of nostalgia on the part of many Polish leaders for a return to a large imperial Poland. Marshal Pilsudski shared these aspirations, and because of this was unable to fit into the sort of fascist coalition that Mussolini and also Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria were able to fit into.
Again, a couple of things. Mussolini being a good example. This was, of course, much the same reason that Mussolini was able to bring the people of Italy behind fascism, was because of the fact that it had been so long since Italy had been a major player. In fact, in the case of Italy, it had been roughly 2,000 years since Italy had been any kind of force on the world political scene. And Mussolini was able to inspire his countrymen with the memories of the legions of Rome and the days that the world quaked to the boots or the sandals of the legions of Rome, or whatever his phrase was that he used, and was able to inspire, just as, again, we mentioned Yoshio Kodama and his idea about combining militarism and nationalism with this sort of samurai ideal of medieval Japan. We notice these things happening very often, these kinds of emotional appeals to a nationalism that is, in many cases, not only ridiculously unpractical, but several thousand years out of date. So this is how Pilsudski was able to appeal to the Polish people and was able to, among other things, to romanticize what was basically, as Dave put it, a fascist country. Again, the other point that needs to be stressed for people who are not familiar with history and have had their fascism and their capitalism and communism packaged for them in TV movies and things, as Dave said, there were numerous people in Germany who were anti-Hitler and were still pro-Nazi. In the same way, the fascists of Poland, especially by the end of the war, were distinctly anti-Nazi, most of them, while nonetheless giving up none of their own pro-fascist mentality. So that's a keen and key important point to remember, that because you are anti-Nazi, you are not necessarily anti-fascist and vice versa.
Also recall that in Radio Free America number 1, we talked about Polish attempts to reobtain parts of the Ukraine. So Polish nationalism and the resulting conflicts with the Soviet Union is something that we've touched on in the past and that has been going on for a long time. Again, Herbert Hoover's efforts aiding the Russo-Polish War of 1921, we talked about in Radio Free America number 1. Okay, now, touching back on a comment that Nip Tuck made, one of the groups which, one of the peoples on in the 20th century who have been affected by an irredentist movement, so to speak, by basically a longing for bygone days of empire, are the Turks. Of course, the Ottoman Turks built a very, very powerful empire encompassing much of Europe during the Middle Ages and just before. And the Turks, although in the 20th century their power was largely eclipsed, there remained among the Turkish people not only a strong longing on the parts of certain people for empire, but also because many, many ethnic Turks lie outside of modern Turkey, there is a strong nationalist movement among the so-called outside Turks, people of Turkish extraction who live outside the borders of modern Turkey. Now, this pan-Turkist movement has been very, very strong in the 20th century, and because many of the Turk-ik speaking peoples lie inside the boundaries of the modern Soviet Union, pan-Turkism took a largely anti-Soviet character in its attempt to unite all Turkic speaking peoples under into one national entity. The pan-Turkist movement has sought the return of many of the Turk-ik speaking areas of the Soviet Union as part of a greater Turkey. And this pan-Turkist movement is one of the things that we're going to be looking at, and its incorporation into the ABN. This will be cropping up later in future broadcasts, in particular in the background of the shooting of the Pope. We're not going to look at that specifically this evening, but we are going to look at the pan-Turkist movement as part of German fascism and even before, and we're going to see how that became incorporated into the ABN.